Thanks everyone for coming. Today it's a pleasure to welcome Georgios Feligiannis, who was available on short notice to give a remote talk. Thanks very much, Georgios, for being available. Georgios has done a lot of really pioneering work on cosmology, on the interface between theory and observations. He did his PhD in Cornell with Rachel Bean, mainly thinking about theories of modified gravity and their observational signatures, and is now a postdoc at Harvard, where he, in addition to modified gravity, is thinking about some really novel and interesting ideas for data analysis. And today he's going to tell us about his ideas applied to galaxy surveys. Go ahead, Georgios.
Great. Awesome. So sharing my screen. Hopefully you can see it, and let's play. Great. So thank you very much for the kind introduction. It's really my great pleasure to be able to connect with you today, even though virtually. And as you just heard, I'm indeed Georgios Feligiannis, and I'm a postdoc at Harvard working in Cora Dworkin's group, who has been my close collaborator in this line of work that I'm going to be discussing today, which is entitled, as you may see, Going Beyond the Galaxy Power Spectrum, an Analysis of Bose Data with Wavelet Scattering Transforms, which actually coincides with the title of our most recent paper that we put out on the archive, but now it's been published a few months ago. And also I'm going to be talking about the previous paper in this line of work, which essentially initiated our interest in this topic. And finally, towards the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about latest ongoing work, also in collaboration with Sandy Yuan from Stanford. So let's start with a brief introduction, even though I know that I'm preaching to the choir in this audience of experts. But so as all of you know, the large scale structure of the universe carries a wealth of information about the underlying fundamental physics, because it has essentially emerged as the outcome of the post-processing of the primordial density field under the influence of the nonlinear process of gravitational instability. And in this exciting time of precision cosmology, a large number of the next stage of cosmological surveys, such as DESI, which is already active, and Rubin LSST and Euclid and many others, are going to very precisely map out the three-dimensional distribution of galaxies in the cosmic web in many different ways. And what this means for us, of course, is that we are going to get a unique opportunity to tackle some of the biggest open questions in fundamental physics, such as the nature of the accelerated expansion of the universe and dark energy, or the particle nature of dark matter, and the properties of massive neutrinos and the properties of gravity at large scales. This is all great. This is very exciting. However, in light of this expected unprecedented increase in the amount of incoming data, one cannot help but wonder, especially theorists like myself, about how to optimally first characterize, but also extract all of this tremendous amount of information that is available in principle in the large scale structure. And perhaps the first step in this quest, if so to say, for an ideal estimator would be to extract the simplest yet meaningful compression of information that is encoded in the cosmic density field, which is nothing else than our familiar two-point correlation function, or equivalently, its Fourier space counterpart, the galaxy power spectrum, which has indeed served as the main object of interest in traditional applications of cosmological parameter inference up to this day, and has also seen tremendous improvement towards efforts to model it, both analytically using perturbation theory, for example, and also using simulation-based approaches in the past decade. And this is all great, it's a very active field. However, unfortunately, we know that the power spectrum is incomplete as an estimator because it fails to capture the non-Gaussian information that is encoded in the large-scale structure of the universe. Or to put it differently, if the cosmic density field followed a perfectly Gaussian distribution, as it was almost the case in the early universe, all of the information would be encoded in the power spectrum, in the two-point function. All higher order correlations would vanish, and that would be the end of it. However, we know that this is not the case because of the action of this nonlinear process of gravitational instability that I mentioned earlier, which is responsible for structure formation and has caused the emergence of non-Gaussianities in the large-scale structure of the universe. So what this means practically for us is that the power spectrum is incomplete if we try to look into the information that we can extract out of it that is carried into it at small scales and late times, it saturates. So we need to do better than that. And perhaps the first, traditionally, the next step, according to this reasoning, to try to tackle this problem would be, of course, to extend our application and include higher order correlations, such as the three-point correlation function, the bispec, and include them into the traditional applications of parameter inference, which is a perfectly reasonable approach and has also seen a lot of progress towards efforts, once again, to model it both using theory and also simulations. However, this moment expansion very quickly becomes intractable because both the associated cost of evaluation, but also the dimensionality of the resulting data vector very quickly blow up with increasing order of evaluation. And in turn, in order to try to overcome this difficulty, another active, very active subfield of cosmology is centered on try to identify some shortcuts, essentially, that try to give us an access into this additional non-Gaussian information without having to evaluate this full correlation hierarchy of moments. And such approaches include, but are not limited to, for example, some non-linear transformations to the density field that try to pull some of this information back to the two-point function. They include some proxy estimators, or for example, the density split statistics that many people over there at Waterloo work on, and many other environmentally dependent statistics beyond the power spectrum. This list is non-exhaustive, so pick your favorite one. And I'll talk about some of these that I've worked also in the past. However, I think even though this is a very active subfield, I think we all agree that the extent to which all of these approaches can actually fully capture all of the available information is still an open question. Now, on the other end, in the last decade or so, convolutional neural networks have quickly emerged as a new ambitious tool that promises to potentially capture all of the available information that is encoded in the target physical field or a configuration, no matter how complicated. And they have indeed demonstrated great promise in the context of simulation-based approaches. However, I think once again, we all agree that despite this great excitement around their use, we're still not sure about the extent to which this performance can actually be harnessed in applications involving actual galaxy data, because first of all, they require a tremendous amount of training of available data sets for training, but also perhaps more importantly, they can be viewed as a giant black box, which raises a lot of concerns about their interpretability, which is something that matters when it comes to physical applications. So this is still an open question. Now, the estimator that I'm going to be discussing today is one that promises to essentially serve, try to combine the strengths of both of these fronts, both of these approaches, while avoiding some of their main disadvantages, and essentially tries to serve as an ideal middle ground between the two, which is named the wavelet scattering transform, and was proposed for the first time about 10 years ago by mathematicians in the context of computer vision and signal processing. And for those of you that have not heard of this before, let's define it first. So what is this wavelet scattering transform? So given an input field, which can be any physical field, but in our case, since we are going to eventually talk about cosmology, this would be the cosmic density field. This WST starts by performing a convolution of this field with a family of localized wavelets. And this family of wavelets can be generated starting with a given mother wavelet that I'm going to precisely define later on in a couple of slides. But for now, you can think of it as just a wavelet that has a given physical scale and has a given orientation in space. And this family of wavelets can be generated by performing a series of dilations to its physical scale, and also a series of rotations to its orientation. And this way one can create a family of wavelets like a basis that spans the whole of space. And I will show more about this shortly. So after performing this convolution, one takes the modulus of the resulting field and finally averages over all of its pixels, which returns a final real number that we call a WST coefficient. And this procedure is very nicely illustrated on this plot here on the right, where we can see that given an input 3D field, in this case, the convolutions with these members of the family of wavelets generate many different versions out of this original field, which, after taking the modulus and average, generate in turn a collection of these WST coefficients up to a given order. And also you can see that the successive subsequent applications of this procedure generate this tree like architecture that we call a scattering network. At each layer of which, we once again end up with a collection of these numbers up to a given order. And you might say, okay, this is all great, this is a nice picture, but why do this? What is the point? Or as a physicist, I would ask, what is the physical meaning of this? So let's look into this closer. So first of all, at zeroth order, this is just obviously the mean value of a field, which is not particularly informative, or for cosmological applications, I would say not informative at all. But things get progressively more and more interesting as we increase the order of evaluation. So at first order of this, and as I said previously, when we perform a convolution with a wavelet that spans a given scale and orientation, the extracted coefficient out of this procedure will essentially characterize the strength of clustering of this field around this given scale and orientation, which is something that reminds us of our familiar power spectrum or the two-point correlation function. And in fact, some of you might have already noticed that if we actually replace this wavelet, this localized wavelet, by a plane wave perturbation, and if we instead raise the modulus of the input field to the power of 2, we recover the power spectrum version of this quantity. So you see how things get interesting for cosmological applications. And they get even more interesting as we keep doing this. If we do this one more time, for example, at second order, and according to this reasoning I just presented, the extracted second order coefficient out of this procedure will essentially characterize the strength of clustering of a clustered structure, or something that you can think of the information related to the correlation function of order 2 to the power of 2, the cluster of a clustered field. So you see that once we do this twice, we are immediately able to access information that lies beyond, non-Gaussian information that lies beyond the power spectrum, which is of course very interesting in light of what I talked about in the introduction. And it turns out that this collection of coefficients can act as a basis that can reflect the clustering properties of an input physical field, just like in cosmology, we traditionally work with our basis of that consists of the power spectrum, the bispectrum, the trispectrum, and so on and so forth. And it actually turns out, mathematicians have proven this, that this basis not only retains all of our familiar desirable properties of the power spectrum, for example, the translation and rotation invariants, but also has some additional properties that are not realized by the power spectrum. For example, it is very compact, meaning the resulting dimensionality of the data vector does not blow up as fast when we increase the order of evaluation. As you will see shortly, I will only work with 75 to 76 coefficients. And also it's very robust because, or more robust than traditional moment expansion, because you notice that the input field always enters this evaluation at a linear fashion. It is never elevated to a very high power, which is the case when one tries to evaluate the endpoint correlation function. And perhaps more importantly, those of you that have some familiarity with machine learning might have already noticed that this scattering network architecture that I presented here essentially resembles the architecture of a neural net, but with fixed kernels, which in our case are played by these members of the family of wavelets, which means essentially that this can be viewed as an interpretable version of a CNN, which is of course, once again, very attractive when it comes to physical applications. So that's why I talked about an ideal middle ground. And this is where things get interesting for cosmology. And about 3 years ago now, so in 2020, there was a first application of this estimator in the context of cosmology, in particular in the context of weak lensing, two-dimensional simulated shear maps by a group at Johns Hopkins. And I believe that Sihao Cheng, who led this work, is also partly affiliated with the Perimeter Institute over there. So after a Fisher forecast on the constraints of parameters, on the constraints obtained on two cosmological parameters, as you can see here, this work found that the constraints obtained by the scattering transform here on the left were not only found to be much better, much tighter than the ones predicted by the traditional power spectrum here shown in the middle panel, but also they were found to be on par with the results obtained by a state-of-the-art CNN that was trained to give constraints on these weak lensing simulations. So this was very exciting. And this is what caught my attention. And because, as you probably realized, I'm someone that tries to think about these questions, but usually in the context of the three-dimensional clustering of galaxies, which is, let's say, more of my expertise. So in the first paper on this topic, we tried essentially in collaboration with Cora Dvorkin, we try to investigate the extent to which this approach can actually be beneficial in the context of an application to the three-dimensional matter cosmic density field. In particular, we worked with the three-dimensional matter, dark matter over density field, as it was obtained by the publicly available suite of the Quixote simulations. So for those of you that have not heard of those before, bottom line, the Quixote simulations is a suite of thousands of simulations that were performed in order to enable one to perform Fisher forecasting in cosmology. So there are thousands of simulations for a fiducial cosmology, such that one can evaluate the covariance matrix. And also there are other thousand linear variations in stepwise fashion of six cosmological parameters, so that one can evaluate derivatives. Yes, Vasily, there is a question.
Well, yeah, I just had a small question. When you were describing the WST before, I was interpreting it as a 2D construction, since the wavelets were parameterized by J and L with no M. And here it looks like you're forecasting a 3D version. Is that something you're going to talk about later, or is it easy to say how the two are related?
I am kind of talk about it. I am going to briefly talk about it, but yeah, that's a great question. So in principle, one can think of it as a construction. This can work with any dimensions. Of course, I guess there is kind of a compression here. But as you will see in this spherical harmonic basis that we're going to work with, there's an actual way in which this a 3D field can be mapped into a way that one can parameterize the strength of clustering around a given scale and orientation. But of course, this is not the only one. So there's no proof, if so to say, that this captures all of the information. So I can think of more improved bases, which is actually something that I'm thinking about these days. So if that answers your question for now, I can show you, I can talk about this later on.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah. Yes, and but yeah, bottom line, that is a good point. So yes, back to the Fisher forecasting. So one can, of course, also evaluate derivatives of an observable. There are six parameters varied in this setup, five standard lambda CDN parameters, and the sum of the neutrino masses. And also let me note that because we have to, because also this setup includes neutrinos, we traced and we work with both the density perturbation, the matter over density of cold dark matter and baryons in the presence of neutrinos, and also the total matter field, including neutrinos. And you will see in a while why these two obviously can give a different result. And we extracted, in order to perform our experiment, three observables. In our Fisher setup, first of all, the standard monopole of the matter power spectrum. And then also we extracted these wavelet scattering transform coefficients with this density field as input, and up to second order using a combination of five different scales and five different orientations, and which results, there's a dimensionality reduction here, eventually results to 76 WST coefficients up to second order. This could be our new data vector. And lastly, we also compared against another higher order statistic, that I have also worked on, and others have also worked on, because, and you will see why this is a meaningful comparison, the Mach power spectrum. So let me also briefly define the Mach power spectrum. So the Mach correlation function, or the Mach power spectrum, is a generalization of the standard two-point function in which its galaxy or its tracer is weighted, but now instead of having just a weight of unity, the same weight, is weighted by a given property that we would like to emphasize over. And this has been used for years in cosmology, for example, to break degeneracies between the properties of a given galaxy and parameters of the Halo model and many different variations of this approach. But in 2016, Martin White proposed that using a marked correlation function in which its tracer is weighted by a transformation that essentially downweights cosmic densities. You see here the density field, the smooth density field is in the denominator. This can actually potentially allow us to obtain powerful constraints on modified gravity. And Because essentially, this is because of the fact that for reasons that I'd be happy to explain if we have time, in cosmic voids, the modifications to gravity for many of these models are more apparent. And given, as Kendrick also said in the introduction, I've also worked a lot on trying to test gravity with cosmology. Back when I did my PhD with Rachel Bean, we investigated this. We tried this idea and we indeed found for some models that using such a Mark correlation function can indeed allow us to more optimally break degeneracies between the standard lambda CDM scenario and some of these alternative gravity theories much better than just using the plain two-point correlation function. And after that, in a very nice PRL work by Elena Massara, who I think is also online joining us today, people tried, this team tried to see, to investigate the extent to which this Mark correlation function can also allow us to constrain all the parameters, but also the sum of the neutrino masses, because we also know that cosmic voids are very sensitive probes of unclustered species like massive neutrinos, and they indeed found this to be the case. So this is a natural, very good competitive statistic to compare against. So back to the two-point, back to the WST, excuse me. So the particular implementation, let me now define it, is a 3D implementation that uses solid harmonic wavelets. And in particular, it consists of our familiar Laplacian spherical harmonics, and then multiplied by a radial polynomial. This is called the solid harmonic in the literature, and then further multiplied by a Gaussian envelope to localize its support. And first of all, this forms our mother wavelet for a given minimum scale that one can probe. And then, of course, this can be dilated to probe larger scales. In our case, we use dyadic dilations of this in its dimension, in 3D dimensions. And then, of course, one can somehow rotate it to capture the angular information. And the way it is done here, to connect back to what Kendrick asked, in this particular implementation, it was a choice of the authors that proposed it. They summed over the one of the two indices of the spherical harmonics, the M, the internal, the M index, and they allowed the variations of the L as the external index, which essentially can allow one to capture angular information through these different harmonics. But of course, this is a choice, but this choice was found to work well and preserve the main properties of the WST, such as I said, translation, rotation, invariance. And there are many other choices in the literature, many other types of such wavelets that, of course, one can consider and one can think about. But for this implementation, we tried this and we found it works well. And also, it's implemented in a publicly available Python package called Kimatio. And even though Kimatio in Greek means wavelet, and Kima means wave. And even though I'm not the one that gave this name, given that I'm Greek, I fully endorse this name. It's very convenient. So this is the implementation we chose to work with. And I see a question, yes.
Hi. The solid harmonics are what, like solutions to the three-dimensional Laplacian, like del squared psi equals zero. And then you have this Gaussian envelope. Is there a rigorous sense in which we know that this is a overcomplete basis for the three-dimensional field like wavelets usually are? Or are we guaranteed that this capture all the information, I guess? It's a good basis function.
That is a great question. And even though mathematicians keep looking into this, I do not think, or as far as I'm concerned, I'm not aware of any concrete rigorous proof that show that this is complete, meaning that this can capture all of the information. But I think that it preserves the main properties and the main properties of the wave scattering transform. And this was the main motivation behind using it, essentially because it is a way to perform scale separation and capture orientation, the translation and rotation invariance, and map out into the standard WST. But yeah, to the best of my knowledge, that is that was the beginning starting point of this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. But yeah, this is of course, even though this is fascinating, and we're also glad to see that starting with what was already tried, we found something that worked very well. One can keep, of course, thinking about finding optimal bases and optimal compressions, especially in the context of cosmology. And I will briefly refer to this in the end, but thank you. This was a very well-motivated question. So, and one last thing, and which will connect back to what I talked about the cosmic voids. In the vanilla implementation of this WST, as I showed previously, the input field enters in a linear fashion, which is actually one of its attractive properties. It doesn't raise the field to a very high function, to a very high power. But if one actually relaxes this assumption a bit and allows this index to vary, but of course not by very much, because we will lose this attractive property, but by a little, and especially if one allows this power to become smaller than unity, this would essentially effectively emphasize on cosmic voids, on smaller values of this, on cosmic densities, which potentially, just like I talked about previously, the context of this other marked correlation function transformation, could emphasize on cosmic voids and be powerful for cosmology. And we looked into this. We allowed this index to vary, and we did a search, a very simple search, and we tried to find the value of this index that would give us the best constraint on the sum of the neutron masses, or actually another two parameters, a joint constraint. And we found, being conservative about this, we were very conservative, that indeed smaller, lower values of this index are preferred. They give us better constraints for some of the neutron masses when we marginalize over the other parameters. So we adopted this power of 0.8 that we're going to be using from now on in all of the subsequent applications. This would be, let's say, our optimal setup. And you see how there are many parallels. But let me show you the results, because I talked a lot. It was a large introduction. So here, let me show you some results. On this plot on the left, on this corner plot, I show the forecast for the one sigma errors marginalized obtained on three cosmological parameters out of the six. First of all, by this basis of the WST coefficients in blue, and then by the standard matter power spectrum in red at z equals zero, and also by this other alternative estimator, the marked correlation function in green. And this is by color matter invariance. And as you can see clearly, visibly, this scattering transform delivers a substantial improvement in the one sigma errors obtained on these parameters compared to the standard power spectrum. And this improvement ranges between 20% and four times tighter than what one gets by the power spectrum. And we found notably that the improvement was particularly good when it comes to the sum of the neutrino masses in connection to what I said above, where the constraint was found to be four times tighter than what one would get from the power spectrum, and even 60% tighter than what one would get from the marked power spectrum, which, as I said previously, was already had already found a very competitive result. And I see that there's another question by Kenny. Yes, please.
Oh, yeah. I was just trying to get a sense for which length scales were being probed by the WST. So I guess I really want to ask two questions. One is, like, what grid resolution do you use when applying the WST? And then also, what is the sigma parameter in the smoothing scale?
Thanks for asking. This is very important. And I should have said it already. So the scale, the minimum scale of the information accessed by this configuration will be essentially controlled by the minimum scale of this matter wavelet. So in this case, we made sure to work. So this sigma parameter was tuned to be 80% of, let's say, 0.8 of the size of the grid. And the size of the grid was about 10 megaparsecs over 8 little on the side. So if one works it out, we found that, and we made sure that this is the case, that the minimum scale, or the maximum Kmax in Fourier space, is pretty much the same as the one we used for the power spectrum and the marked power spectrum, which is about 0.5 or 0.5-ish, which is the limit down to which one can try the Quixote simulations.
Oh, great. That was the next question I was going to ask, is what Kmax you used in the PFK?
Yes. Yes, and I should add, to be also fair to the literature, that later on, follow-up work also tried to be even more rigorous about it. They made another base of wavelets that is even more strict at localizing scales than a Gaussian, and they found pretty much that the WST does indeed work well, but you know, test more thoroughly. So yes, that is indeed a great question, and one always needs to be mindful about the scales. So let me also show you the full corner plots. So here on the left is the full version of what I showed you above, by when we work with the combination of quadrant matter and baryons, where you see again, you know, visualized this improvement in all of the parameters. And on the right, I also show the equivalent result when one uses as input the total matter field, including the neutrino perturbations. And where you can see even visually that the improvement found by the WST, but also by the Mach power spectrum, actually, as in the Massara et al. Paper, they also pointed this out, is very substantial. Actually, in the case of the sum of the neutrino masses, the constraints are 100 times tighter than what one can get by the power spectrum. But one needs to be mindful here, because this was also very nicely explained in a nice work by the Berkeley group that came out around the same time as our paper. This quantity is not observable. So what this plot essentially says is that if one could observe the full 3D total matter field, including neutrinos, one could get very tight neutrinos, very tight constraints on the sum of the neutrino masses, which kind of makes sense. But this is not observable. What is observable is the plot on the left. So even though this is an interesting exercise, one needs to be mindful of it. So of course we included both, but I think this is a good point worth making. And lastly, to summarize, so we of course found that the wavelet scattering transform did indeed work very well, and better than the power spectrum, and in some cases than the competition. But why is that the case? We attributed it to two main physical properties. Let me just reiterate them. First of all, the successive layers of this WST are able to pick up higher order information that lies beyond the power spectrum, beyond the two-point function, which is known. So when one works with higher order statistics, it is known, of course, that we can improve, get better constraints on cosmological parameters, on all of them, but also in particular in the case of the sum of the neutrino masses, as it was found in recent forecasts using the Halo and Galaxy power spectrum, also using the Quijote simulations. So this makes sense. And also on top of that, our choice to allow for such a variation in the power of the density field that would allow us to focus on cosmic underdensities or cosmic voids, allowed us to capture even more valuable information that is included in these areas when it comes to the neutrino masses in particular, but in general cosmological parameters. And essentially, there, as was also found in the Mach power spectrum application by Elena et al. And as you can see, there are, of course, many parallels between the WST and such other estimators as the Mach power spectrum. Only in this WST, they were realized in a completely novel way, a completely different way of thinking about this. So this was all very exciting. And this got us very excited because it indeed confirmed our intuition, our expectation that this statistic can be very valuable in the context of cosmological applications of the 3D clustering. But so far, everything I presented had to deal with just the underlying dark matter field, which again, this is not observable either. Because we know that surveys of the large scale structure observe galaxies or partly observed galaxies, which do not perfectly trace this underlying matter field, but are, as we say, biased tracers of it, which are also, in the case of spectroscopic observations that use the Doppler effect, observed in redshift space. And introducing a known anisotropy to the observed clustering pattern that we call the redshift space distortions. And even though I know that all of you probably here know this, this is caused due to the peculiar velocities of galaxies around the homogeneous Hubble flow. So on top of that, of course, one needs to deal with additional layers of systematics that have to do with how a survey will observe the universe. So bottom line, if we are to be able to use such an estimator in the context of an actual galaxy survey, we need to do much better than that. And this was the question we tried to tackle, or at least take a first hint, a first approach at in our second paper on this series, once again with Cora, and we presented the very first application of this wavelet scattering transform now to the three-dimensional residual space galaxy field, as it was observed by an actual survey. In our case, this was the publicly available BOSS CMAS DRPLF dataset in these residual planes, and you can see it actually visualized here. And BOSS observed two patches of the sky, one in the northern hemisphere and another one in the southern hemisphere, and we work with both of those as it's commonly done. Now, when working with survey data, some things are slightly different. So the fundamental quantity of interest here is the so-called Feldman-Kaiser-Peacock FKP field, which is again the galaxy field, of course. But now in this time, it's weighted by a set of weights that are usually chosen such that they capture some of the main systematic effects that one has to deal with in the context of a survey, such as fiber collisions and other sorts of incompletes of the data set. And of course, without getting into too much detail about this thing, this technical part, we need to deal with the fact that the fields we observe are now not periodic. It's not a periodic 3D cube as we work with simulations. It's a masked field, and that occupies, as we say, a non-trivial survey geometry that we also needed to take into account. But fundamentally, this is the quantity of interest that will be either Fourier transformed to give us the standard multiples of the power spectrum in the standards analysis, or in our case, this will be fed again as an input into this scattering network to give us the WST coefficients. So to be more precise, the question we tried to answer, of course, the fundamental question in parameter inference was to investigate the extent to which this estimator could allow us to constrain a collection of cosmological parameters, a vector theta, given some data set in this Bayesian formal notation here. In our case, of course, once again, the data set is the BOSS CMAS data set. And as an estimator, we used, once again, this vector of WST coefficients with the same configuration, which once again gives 76, one of those coefficients out of, down to second order. And also, once again, now we compare it against the multiples of the galaxy power spectrum. And now we use the, we restrict this to larger scales in both estimators. And notice that now I'm talking about multiples because we have to deal with an anisotropic field. So we have to deal, we also have a quadrupole, let's say. So the comparison was between these two, so that we can have a benchmark and see, you know, whether once again we can get an improvement out of this. Of course, to perform parameter inference, we need to combine our estimator with a particular model that will capture the cosmological dependence of it as a function of the parameters that we try to constrain. And this is where things might get a bit more complicated or challenging or expensive for such the higher order statistics that are evaluated at the field level, because one needs to have access to the full field as a function of the parameters. There are no known theory model, analytical model, just like for the power spectrum, we have very nice perturbation theory models. So this is where luckily simulations come to the rescue. So in particular, we use the publicly available suite of the Abacus Summit simulations that were developed here by our friends at the Center for Astrophysics and Daniel Eisenstein's group. So I don't want to get into very technical details about the simulations, but let me very quickly say that these are state-of-the-art simulations that also created the galaxy mocks, galaxy mock catalogs that resemble the clustering properties of our target galaxy sample, the BOSS, and they also have the capability to do it for DESI, for the next generation. And they do this as a function of some other cosmological parameters, and they use a semi-analytical halo occupation distribution model to parameterize, to capture the physics of galaxy formation. And lastly, of course, we need to cut these fields such that they occupy the realistic survey geometry, the same as the survey, which is what we need. And let me show you just one such example. So here in this plot, I plot the WST coefficients going from zero order on the left all the way to second order. There are 76 of those, as I said, and the angular index varies faster and the spatial index varies slower. And you can see these coefficients as they're obtained by the BOSIMAS dataset in the blue circles and by one instance of these Abaco simulations for the Planck that corresponds to the Planck 2018 cosmology. They look pretty close to each other. They do not overlap. It's just that because this cosmology is pretty close to, say, the true universe, they look very close. We can't tell them apart by naked eye. And here on the right, I show the same comparison for our standard estimator, the benchmark estimator, the monopole of the galaxy power spectrum on the bottom subpanel, and the quadrupole on the top, and then the quadrupole on the bottom. But this is just for uncosmology. Here I showed this for Planck. But remember, again, if we think about our traditional parameter inference applications in cosmology, we have a model that will give us the dependence of our data vector as a function of an arbitrary choice of these parameters within the whole parameter space. And this is where things might once again get a bit challenging, because at the moment that we were working on this, the full entire Abaco suite of simulations was not available. So at that time, we had to perform an approximation. And I would like to note that the next two or three slides will show results that are subject to this approximation. But at the end, I will show you the newer results in which we've moved beyond this. But for now, the approximation we performed was just a simple Taylor expansion around the Planck fiducial cosmology, which, of course, you know, is expected to be accurate close to the fiducial, but not very accurate away from it. So combining this, of course, one needs to have, if we make an assumption of the Gaussian likelihood, that is a common assumption under the central limit theory, one needs, of course, to have a prediction for the covariance matrix of a given observable, which we obtained using another suite of simulations that were made publicly available by the Bosch collaboration, specifically in order to enable covariance matrix estimation. And this is where the suite of Patchimoks, there's thousands of those, so that we can get a well-defined covariance matrix. And lastly, now we are able to put all the pieces together, combine the different ingredients of our model to perform parameter inference, or to do to run an MCC chain and see the constraints we can get on these parameters. And I see that there's a question. Yes?
Yeah, so I was just curious, is there some way to see if these WST coefficients can somehow encode the NAC? I mean, so can they somehow encode the anisotropy of the clustering, similar to how the quadrupole versus monopole does?
Yes, very good question. So there is a way, but I should know that this implementation was meant to be used for, or was introduced in the context of an isotropic field. So in principle, this basis does not fully capture the anisotropy. Of course, it might capture some of it. And actually, it's a very interesting but a deep question. I've talked about this with some mathematicians that work on this. There was an interesting back and forth. So one would expect that as one evaluates this WST coefficients locally around its tail, let's say its region of space of the density field, these different harmonics would change when one works with an isotropic field versus an anisotropic one, because of course the structure and the filaments and everything that is captured by this WST will change. But in principle, this basis will not fully capture this. So it's like, I like to view, to think about this as the monopole equivalent of the WST, but it still works very well. But there are ways to go beyond this. There are new bases that have now been introduced that can treat a given direction, such as the direction of anisotropy, of RSD in this case, as preferred. We are actually working on this. But because of that, we didn't get into a more sophisticated study because we knew that this was not fully complete. And I don't know if this answered your question.
Yeah, I think so. Well, okay. So just to make sure that I'm understanding, so on your basis for the YLMs, so M is the azimuthal number relative to some, to some z-axis, but the z-axis there is not the radial direction. It's instead some, just some choice, arbitrary choice.
Some choice in the local, yeah. Exactly. It's like Yeah, exactly. These are, and I wish I had, there's a nice plot where people can plot these harmonics, these wavelets, and or a projection of them in 2D around a given cell. And we see that, of course, the orbitals change as we take different Ls. So, but all of this is positioned each time at the center of each cell. So it's not, it's defined with regards to where it's a wavelet is positioned in the on the grid.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. That was a good thing to clarify. So now, let me show you how well it works. Once again, here on the plot on the left, I show the marginalized constraints on the one sigma errors contained on three cosmological parameters again by this WST, and in blue, in the blue contours, and once again by the multiples of the galaxy power spectrum in the red contours, and where you can see. First of all, before we get to the performance, we see that broadly speaking, the mean values of the parameters are consistent with each other within one sigma of the power spectrum, which it matters because, of course, we want our novel statistic to recover a sensible cosmology. And I will show more about how we can test this, how we're testing this now. But more importantly, perhaps, one can even visually see that once again, this statistic delivers a substantial improvement on the one sigma errors that can be obtained on these cosmological parameters in all of these different cases and in all of these different tests that we perform. In some cases, even the improvement is even better, is better than what we found in the matter application. And we used the Gaussian prior on omega B, as people do, or even flat priors. Again, the performance is great. So bottom line, we were very excited about this result because, again, it demonstrated, in my opinion, the great promise held in the use of this estimator in the context of precision cosmology and applications to galaxy data. But if I have a bit more time, let me also show you a little bit about the latest ongoing work. Because specifically, remember, I said that all of these results, even though more realistic and exciting, were subject to a given approximation, this Taylor expansion of the cosmological dependence. Now, ever since we completed this work, the full collection of these Abaco simulations now is available. So now we, in collaboration with also with Sandy Yuan from Stanford, we are working with a full suite of 85,000 of those galaxy mocks that span the 11-dimensional parameter space of our model. And we use a neural net to train and learn the precise cosmological dependence of our data vector, which is, again, these WST coefficients. And one way to test whether, of course, our model works well is to do some recovery tests, some holdout tests, meaning we can have we can pick some cosmologies that have been performed, some simulations that have been performed for points within the parameter space, but that didn't participate in the training. And we call them holdout because we put them aside. And then after we train our model, we try to see if we can recover the true cosmology that is known accurately and precisely. So now we are glad after a lot of training, we're happy to say that we've passed all of these tests. This work is partly done within DESI also. And here, for example, I show such a successful recovery for one such instance where you see that, first of all, we are able to recover the correct values here represented of the parameters here shown by the black dust vertical lines within one sigma. And also, perhaps equally importantly, we find once again, if one looks into the one sigma errors, more or less, we once again find that we can competitively constrain the values of the cosmological parameters. And we find that we're in agreement, we can confirm the conclusions of the previous paper that used the approximation. So this was very exciting. And I would also like to note that this is a mock that corresponds to a low sigma 8 because this is a parameter of interest, but also because this is a point that lies closer to the edge of the parameter space. So it's more challenging to get accurately. And I see there is a question. Yes, please.
Yeah. Can you go to the previous slide, please?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, actually, one more back.
Here, yes.
Yeah. So here you get with WST, you get... like the mean values. Yeah, I'm trying to understand how they compare with Planck actually values and whether they're biased or not. Yeah, so in unrestricted priors, it looks that like they are shifted, right, with respect to Planck.
Yeah, But actually, in both cases, no, that is a great question, and I can answer it. And please let me know if I didn't answer it properly. So we compared a lot against, first of all, or we kept Planck in mind, but also what we did keep in mind was the results found by the publicly available reanalysis of Bose using the power spectrum and the bias spectrum. Because as you probably know, especially these days, there's a lot of interest in reanalyzing Bose using the EFT of LSS, effective field theory motivated perturbation theory approaches. So we both find, we find with WST that we get a lower value, sigma 8 is biased low compared to Planck. But what is very interesting is that this is also the conclusion of both the Princeton IAS and also the Berkeley group. They also seem to find that sigma 8 is biased low. And it's a big question about whether this is connected to the Lessing's law tension or this is another systematic of this CMAS data set. But because of the fact that we are in agreement with them, that gave us greater degree of confidence. Then also NS, we have not used the prior. And this is also known that if you let NS be free, and try to reanalyze Bose even with the power spectrum, you get a lower value. But of course, you can add the tight prior, which we didn't do, but of course, that's what is commonly done. Here, we want to let things free. And aside from that, the rest is pretty much close to it. So let me know if there's another parameter.
Well, yeah, thanks for the answer. But yeah, I'm wondering about the following. Yeah, I think that's related to like a bigger question. So, like in the exercise with MOX, you basically recover the true cosmology. That's good. That means that the model kind of trained on simulations reproduces simulations correctly. But the mm-hmm. my question is or concern whether like simulations are precise enough, right? So in the sense that like whether like the model trained on simulations reproduces the real physics precisely enough. And I think question here is how would you assess that?
Yes, thank you. That is a great question. First of all, just one, because I want to be honest, this particular result I'm showing, even though the results for sigma 8 are in agreement with other, analysis, was more approximate because when we use the Taylor expansion, that might introduce also some error in the mean values recovery. In the follow-up work, now we are testing, we've tested against the MOX, and this is the one that will give the final answer. So we are now reanalyzing both CMAS, but we have not completed it. But to answer your question, because it is a good one, one way to go about it, or one, let's say, one of the best ways, the best we can do is that here, yes, we trained everything against the Abacus Summit simulations, which used the HALO model, the HOD model. And then we tested against Abacus simulation. So of course, your question is how do we know they're accurate? Another thing we can do, which we did, and it was my next slide actually, was to then use the same model, trained on Abacus, and try to recover the parameters of a totally different simulation, also state of the art, but that uses a totally different assumptions about galaxy physics. In particular here, we try to recover the parameters of an Utsu MOG, which uses abundance matching, so a different model than HOD. And here you see, and this was, let's say, the hardest test we've passed so far. And here you see, again, we can recover the cosmologies. There might be a bit of a shift, but within one sigma. So this is used to give us some greater degree of confidence that our modeling is robust against the assumptions about galaxy physics. Of course, then one might wonder, how do we know that this is enough? And then the next step is what I was going to say in the end, but since I'm finishing up, I can say it now, that there are blinded challenges. Everything here was unblinded, meaning we had some simulations, we knew the true parameters, but there are blinded challenges that are getting increasingly popular both in cosmology, in many surveys, but also in particle physics, where someone performs a simulation, they make whatever assumptions they can make, they choose. They give us the galaxy catalog and we try to recover the true parameters. And then it's unblinded and we compare and we can do this many times against different simulations to, you know, convince the community that we can trust this. Mm-hmm. So this is the state of the art, let's say.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks because that preemptively allowed me to say something I wanted to say. And let me conclude here. I see we're reaching the hour. So to summarize, I presented the wavelet scattering transform, a novel statistic that promises to efficiently extract the non-Gaussian information that is encoded in the physical field and serves as an ideal middle ground between convolutional neural networks and traditional estimators. And I presented the very first application of this WST to actual galaxy spectroscopic data through a reanalysis of this Bose CMAS dataset, which demonstrated that we can indeed use it to get a great substantial improvement in the one sigma errors obtained on cosmological parameters compared to the standard power spectrum. And there are a lot of ongoing work and improvements we've been making. Some of these are the emulator and the mock tests that I just talked about. And all of these are, or some of these are culminating into a new paper that I'm now writing in which we will reanalyze CMAS now more robustly. But we are confirming the same conclusions that we found in the previous paper. And of course, one can keep improving these as simulations themselves improve. And finally, let me talk a little about the potential interesting applications. First of all, the work that I showed previously is partly done within DESI, within the DESI collaboration. In particular, I'm leading a project which aims to use this wavelet scattering transform in order to constrain the values of cosmological parameters using this WST from DESI year one data. DESI is already collecting data. And there's a lot of interest in these higher order statistics, such as also other people at Waterloo have been working on. And first of all, aside from constraining the standard parameters of lambda CDM, which I showed here, one of course can use this to constrain the sum of the neutrino masses, which we know from the forecasting with Quixote that we can constrain them very well. But we didn't apply it to the data because the Abacus simulations did not vary neutrinos. But next generation of simulations will do that. So I'm excited about this. And also, because even though I talked a lot about the data, let's not forget that I'm first and foremost a theorist. So I try to think about how we can use all of these techniques and the data sets to constrain fundamental physics. So there's a variety of other ways one can utilize this powerful approach because, for example, we know that these higher order statistics, as I found, for example, when I was working on modified gravity or in my work in gravity, can also constrain theories of gravity and also can constrain primordial non-Gaussianity, given that we can capture higher order information. So these are exciting new dimensions that I'm thinking about pursuing. And also, just before finalizing, once again, testing the theory of gravity is another long-time interest of mine. So this talk was about the WST, but whoever wants to talk about this as well, I'm very happy to talk about this offline. And lastly, this can, of course, be expanded to lensing. Because, and remember, in my very first plot by the Hopkins group, we know that this statistic can be applied to lensing. There's even an improvement version, the wavelet phase harmonics that can enable cross correlations with potentially great exciting applications to lensing data by LSST, the Rubin Observatory, and Euclid. And I'm also part of LSST where I lead the effort to test gravity. So having said all of that, I'm very excited about this work and about what the future, what lies ahead in the future for this. And I would like to thank you again for the kind invitation and see if there are any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Georgios, for a really inspiring and interesting talk. Why don't we all unmute for a second to applaud?
Thank you. I was happy to. And I know we had many questions during the talk, but yeah, there are more.
Let me remind everyone that there's a Google Doc to sign up to chat in Zoom with Georgios. If you don't have the link, just let me know and I'll send it to you. Why don't we just have one or two questions in the seminar for now. Jesse.
Hey, thanks for the nice talk. I'm curious about your plans or ideas for extending this to different cosmological models. Like you mentioned testing gravity. Does that require running or having simulations run in those models? Or do you have ideas for consistency tests or things that could let you approach that without having to have a new set of n-body simulations?
Right. Great. Thanks for this, because this is also something that it's been a lot on my mind lately, but we didn't have time to talk about. So I would say both, but I would also like to acknowledge that maybe these statistics have a lot of advantages, but one, let's say, disadvantage is that they require training. But even if that's the case, even if one is pessimistic, luckily, because there's a lot of interest in testing these models of fundamental physics, simulations have been developed. Like, for example, for modified gravity, now there is a new suite of state-of-the-art mocks by people in the UK that vary this for many different well-motivated models, both in the context of Lensing and clustering. And also the same, like the Quixote simulations that I talked about, now they have a primordial non-Gaussianity suite. But again, of course, there are some limitations. So to go beyond this, I also have ideas about consistency tests, but which I'm thinking about. This is another thing that has been a lot of my mind ever since the last DESI meeting and discussions I had with people. And to do this, I believe that we can go about it by using new wavelet bases that are tailored to pick up information related to the given models we're going to test. And this is doable, but more work is needed for me to be able to give you a concrete answer. But I believe that yes, the answer is yes to both. And hopefully that answers your question, at least for now. Thanks.
Next question is from Alex Fulci.
Hi, Georges. I just had a couple of small questions. So one was, why is it that when you free omega b, you get actually a lower value of omega c? And then the other was, why, and sorry if I missed your explanation of this, but why are you getting so much better constraints from the matter p of k than from the cb p of k on all parameters, not just the neutrinos?
Great questions, and thanks, Alex, very observant. So I noticed, even though I'm not sure if I'm going to fully answer this first question, but I noticed that in all the tests I performed with all the different models, that there's some kind of correlation between omega B and omega C. So if you free omega B, and it usually, you know, it settles down in a different value, usually lower, it seems that omega C is kind of follows or moves a bit along with it. So I guess think about the fact that there's probably some correlation between the two parameters, which doesn't seem to propagate to others. So it's these two that might move one. And I mean, we know, right, that even when we work with these larger scales, we can't get, you know, a very good constraint on omega B. So I wasn't surprised to find that the mean value wouldn't be as precise. And later on, you can let me know if I didn't cover it properly. About your second question, and you asked, can you remind me again? Right. So what seems to be happening, this is very interesting, is that the matter power spectrum in particular when you introduce neutrinos, and the original people that work on the Quixote simulations did a lot of forecasts with this. There's degeneracies. So there are a lot of degeneracies that prevent the matter power spectrum from being able to obtain better constraints, which seem to be broken when one introduces these additional statistics that capture more information about the full matter field. There's even a nice plot, which I'm not sure if this is from the Quixote or from the original Quixote or the Mark power spectrum work. I think it's from the Quixote, where you see that this is from the all matter power spectrum. You see that as you start to include smaller and smaller scales and you go up down to K max of 0.5, which is what we used, there's a plateau. And the original Quixote people said that this was due to degeneracy between the parameters. So it seems that all of these higher order statistics, also the Mark power spectrum, can break through this. Probably you can capture more information. So even though the power spectrum plateaus at a very high level, then you can break through and this keeps going down. So I hope that gave you some intuition, but happy to talk about this further. These are great questions.
Great, thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, since we're a few minutes over, why don't we just break for now? Everyone should like to encourage everyone to sign up to meet with Georgios in Zoom. And let's thank Georgios again for a super interesting talk.
Great, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. And of course, I'm happy to meet with people further. Sign up. Thanks. You stop sharing.
Right, thanks.
Thanks, awesome. Everyone.
Thanks.